The Viridian Nutrition range of 200-plus award-winning products includes vitamins, minerals, herbs, nutritional oils, specialty supplements, tinctures, and balms, all formulated to be healthful, efficacious, and pure. By choosing our Viridian Nutrition range, you are one step closer to your goal of 100% wellness. Ethical vitamins with an organic heart. Available at all Browns outlets. Browns and you.
On this show, we're indulging in Miral Chardonnay Terre Siciliane, a lively wine for lively conversation. Welcome to the She Word, conversations that women rarely have, but really should. And I think you're going to really enjoy this conversation. This show is titled Women and Pleasurable Sex, Expectations versus Reality and Everything That You Need to Know. Society and the way that we live our lives has changed exponentially in the past 50 years. But for most of us, where we find our information about sex and the impression that we have about sex, and therefore our expectations of our sexual experiences, really hasn't changed very much. If anything, we're just learning more from media and online. Recent studies show that young people often get knowledge of sex from their peers, or the internet, or pornography, often learning vulgar terms and skewed impressions of what sex and relationships look like. More frequently, parents find it difficult to teach about physical and psychological aspects of sex, perhaps because of their own sexual education. In the UK, a study with young people reported that information about sex came from four main sources. The most frequent were friends at 75%, teachers about 60%, mothers 59%, and media 57%. But it's rare to see a good film or a Netflix show that doesn't have sex scenes in it. And even more rarely do we ever find a scene that portrays sex as anything less than instantly fulfilling, even with complete strangers. Therefore, for most, we are led to question our sex life, our expectations versus reality. Well, to dispel these myths and guide us through this wonderful topic, I have a table of amazing and wonderful women. Anna Catania.
Hello.
A highly respected and recommended qualified counsellor specialised in the area of sex and relationships, who offers counselling and psychotherapy to individuals and couples who are having difficulties with sexuality, relationships, and intimacy. But more than that, Anna, I think this is your fourth show.
It is.
This is the fourth time you've been here.
Yes, thank you.
Every time we talk about sex, you have to come and sit at the table. Nicola Falzan is back for a third show?
Yep. That's right.
Having brought her energy and a wealth of knowledge to two previous shows on the topic of sex, Nicola is a community services manager at YMCA Malta. And you're going to have to help me. I always get this wrong. Gestalt. Gestalt.
close.
Psychotherapist and mental and sexual health advocate. Pamela Borge is here for the first time. Pamela, thank you for being with us. You're a counsellor. You're also passionate about supporting people to grow in their awareness and live their most fulfilling, authentic lives. And you work with individuals experiencing difficulties with mental health, gender, sexuality, relationships, and adjusting to life transitions. Ladies, I'm so delighted to have you here. Thank you for being here to talk about sex.
Thank you for having us.
Keep your self-care journey on track in just a few clicks with Myoka Spas. Whether for a moment of disconnection, a complete body-mind reset, or a bonding time together, book online stress-free at myoka.com or use the new Myoka app. Complimentary spa facilities on every visit.
Well, listen, before we go any further, I'm going to see if we can fill in the gaps. And Nicola, I'm going to start with you because you're smiling at me there. You are also, since we last had you on the show, you're now engaged. You are betrothed to get married.
Yes, I am betrothed.
So I like the way you said that. I am betrothed. So a massive congratulations to you. But have I missed anything out?
No, I don't believe so. This is a topic, as you know, since I've been here before, I'm super passionate about it. I love discussing it. I love teaching it and I love learning about it. So I'm happy to be here with these wonderful professionals as well.
Absolutely. Amazing ladies. Anna, you've been here. This is your fourth rodeo with the show. Have I missed anything out?
Not really. I mean, it is always really fun to be here. I enjoy the way the conversations go, and it's lovely to be here with Nicola again and with Pam for the first time. So
brilliant!
Thank you for having me.
Brilliant. Well, Pamela, Pam or Pamela?
Either. I answer to both.
Okay, let's stick to Pam then. We're going to get very informal right in the first 5 minutes. Pam, did I miss anything out about you?
Not really. No, it's my first time here. As you said, I'm really excited to be sharing this discussion with you, ladies, and. Yeah, let's get on with it.
Well, look at that. Pam has already taken control of the show. Listen, first up, I want to say once again, thank you for being here. We've sat at the table before and we've had conversations about sex from slightly different angles, but I honestly feel like we can't have too many shows about sex. And even if we discuss similar aspects of it, we can't do it too many times because it's such an essential part of our life and it's such an important conversation that we really don't have. Look, very few women are actually guided as to what successful sex looks like. It appears sex education hasn't really significantly moved on from even when I was at school 35 years ago, which was one lesson very much aimed at safe sex, how you have sex, nothing to do with the pleasure of sex. And then I came home and my mum gave me a book, which really was, I've looked it up, it's still available and it really doesn't have anything to do with the pleasure of sex either. So sex education is very much motivated by avoiding unwanted pregnancies, the mechanics of it. But from your impressions, I gave out some statistics. Where are you aware that women and young women get their information about sex and what they know? Where does that come from in your experience? Because you guys talk to women.
I do agree that most people do achieve their information mostly from peers and also from pornography. I think when it comes to women specifically, I think a lot of women don't talk about it still. People are talking about it more and more, and people are coming even more forward in therapy. But I think it's because of conversations like this and because of discussions like this where people are starting to understand that you can have questions and it's okay to have questions, not that you don't understand everything. So I still think that the majority of information, while sex education has improved, maybe not to where we need it to be, the pleasure aspect is still missing, definitely. And yes, maybe nowadays sex education is a bit better, but the people that are 25, 30, 40, that obviously aren't getting new sex education unless they look for it, maybe don't have that information. So that's why this is important.
Yeah, for sure. It's a good point you said there, because of course I'm not, it's a long time since I had my education and things might have moved on, but I'm still...
I teach undergrad students at university. And when we discuss the topic of sex education, it's still very much focused on not getting pregnant. It's also focused on not getting STIs, sexually transmitted infections. There is nothing about pleasure. There is very little about consent. So things have improved, but I'm not sure in schools we're having the conversations that should be happening even from a young age. Mm. For example, we know that in the Nordic countries, which are the gold standard of sex education, this conversation starts as early as age four, mm-hmm. where they talk about relationships, they talk about how to stay safe, they normalize the body as a function. For example, I show a video in my classes that is shown in the Netherlands at age eight about breasts. And it is really normalized. Different kinds of breasts are shown, the different developmental stages. A lactating breast is shown with milk coming out. It's really fun. A very normalized way of talking about breasts. Whereas most of the sex education, most of the conversation we have is sexualized mm-hmm. around breasts, for example. Mm-hmm. It's not mm-hmm. normalized so much. When breasts are another part of our body, although they can be used in during sexual intimacy, they are functional as well. So
absolutely.
We don't have those conversations in schools.
Well, let me ask you, because is the fear... Look, we laughed before we hit record on the cameras, because I think it was the very first show that you had said clitoris. And I was like, oh, I'm English. We don't say clitoris. But there is something about that. I come from a very stoic, very reserved, very... polite country. I'm British, and you say clitoris and I automatically will go because that's the way that we are, or at least that's the way that my generation
but
is.
It is because of my training that I say it so
exactly,
easily.
Exactly. But you're familiar. You're talking about the Nordic countries. So my question is, if then, because this might be a lot of people's thought, if you're talking about sexual pleasure to younger people, to educating young people, does that not make them promiscuous?
I think it's all about, as Anna said, for example, it starts off with discussions on friendships, on relationships, on boundaries. So it's building up the knowledge in a way that it's making sense related to the stage of life. It has nothing to do with, I think this idea comes from the notion that if we have more information, we're more likely to explore it. Sometimes it's the opposite, and research backs up that it's the opposite. When you have less information, you're more likely to be curious and then perhaps not do things responsibly or not know enough to protect yourself or to even understand the concept of consent, for example, and how to talk about that. I think if we're focusing on consent in general, to give an example, if we're taught from a younger age how to say yes and no in any context, and we're building that confidence and understanding a powerful yes and a powerful no, it's then by the time we're understanding it in the context of relationships and sex, it makes much more sense and it's much more well understood.
Exactly. For example, if we take parenting here in Malta, we have this habit of going to in-laws and go kiss your nanna. You're not going to say goodbye and kiss your nanna and hug your nanna. There is almost a pressure mm-hmm. on the younger kids to be physical, and because you owe it to elders to hug them before, where actually we can start from a younger age teaching our young kids. And if you don't like that kiss from nanno because it's a bit slobbering, you can say no. Mm-hmm. Not the parents actually push and asking permission. Can I give you a hug before you leave? And as Nicola well said, if this is introduced from a very young age, this agency that you can hug whoever you want, you can receive hugs, you decide from whom to receive hugs. The fact that that's a grandparent does not make it obligatory to them. I think it will, if we give them more agency, then when they come to the area of relationships and intimate relationships, obviously they will be able to say and decide for themselves who they want to engage in intimacy with.
I never, I'm coming to you, Pamela, because mm-hmm. you're nodding away and I'm thinking to myself, you got to jump in there because these two are talkers, right? But I never, ever heard in any of my schooling, my education, ever reference to saying yes or no, to consent or not consent in any way, shape or form.
Yeah. And I really appreciated before how Anna was mentioning to normalize, you know, to normalize certain aspects. And what you are mentioning now, when in schools, whatever, in our families, we are telling children and educating them about issues having to do with sex, you know, about our bodies. It has to do with informed consent. So basically, you're giving the children, the people concerned, the information, and then they are free to do with that as they wish, you know. But if they're not informed, then exactly where are they getting their education from?
Well, you've led really nicely on to my next question, because statistics show that from movies, media, porn, and discussions with peers, that's where a lot of the information is coming from. And this presents a real problem in terms of expectations versus reality, because we're going to talk about very much about that today. Because sex is portrayed in movies as pretty much always satisfying. You wouldn't do it any other way. I mean, the movie's going to be a flop if there's a flop. You know what I'm saying? But the woman orgasms on the first touch, even if it is a complete stranger. It's all perfectly tidy and highly satisfying, and everything works really, really nicely from the moment. And with all due respect, we know in reality that's utter bollocks. There's no other way of saying it. It's total bollocks. That's not what happens. So I can only imagine that less women will share with their friends that they've got challenges in their sex lives, because everywhere we see it portrayed, it's successful. It's like, I touch you and you're like, oh, you know. Yes. And as you said, rightly again, before we came and sat down at this table, we were discussing the fact that a woman walks in to home from work and she suddenly strips off, and we know that's not going to happen. You go straight to the fridge if you need to in my house. But so what is reality for women and men in terms of expectations versus reality, and what implications does this have for a relationship? So if this is what we're seeing in media, what are we seeing in counseling, what are we seeing in the real world?
I mean, there's a lot of different expectations we can go into. First one that's coming into my head is that the expectation that sex is always good and that it's good on the first try, which is, I mean,
is everyone at the table going, we know that one.
Exactly, because it's a skill. It's something you have to practice at. I had a friend of mine once tell me, just because you're good at playing tennis doesn't mean you're going to be good at playing with everyone, because it's different with everyone.
Exactly. That's a good point.
That's a nice...
And even if you are, let's say, particularly good in any technique or whatever it is with a particular partner, not every partner is going to enjoy the same thing. So you have to relearn with every new person that you're with. So even that expectation needs to be thrown out the window, that everybody's going to know what to do and everything's going to tick everyone's boxes, because it's not the case.
Actually, we talk about good enough sex in the world of sex therapy and sexology. That it doesn't have to be, because of media and pornography and films, we have this expectation that is fireworks are going to start bursting off everyone's head.
It's festa everywhere.
Yes, it's not. I mean, sometimes it's really lovely and it's fulfilling and it's prolonged because maybe you can sleep in on a Sunday morning. Sometimes it's a quickie at the end of a very exhausting day and it's 75% okay and everyone goes to sleep. And that's good enough. That's fine. I mean, it doesn't have to be mind-blowing. We have, again, reality versus expectation. We have this expectation that sex has to be mind-blowing every single time. No.
It creates a lot of pressure.
It creates a lot of pressure on both partners in a relationship. Whether it's a heterosexual or a gay relationship, it creates a lot of pressure. And because then it... Maybe there is the problem with performance anxiety, and you need, because you have this expectation that sex has to be 2-3 times a week and mind blowing every single time, then you feign orgasm, and then you
get super disappointed if it doesn't work
yes,
out.
Yes, or you say, I cannot do 45 minutes of sexual intimacy today. So I have a headache. I'm sorry. I need to sleep. Tomorrow I need to wake up at 5. So because of these expectations versus reality, we are creating a world where sex has to be mind-blowing every time. And that's not reality, especially in long-term relationships, especially also in not long-term relationship. If I'm meeting someone at a bar for the first time, I don't know what he likes. He doesn't know what I like.
That's exactly what Pam was saying, is that you can't expect it. And you said it as well, Nicky. You can't expect it to be perfect on the first time.
Exactly.
Because there's way too many variables, right?
Mm-hmm. And you cannot just, sorry, Nick, you cannot expect it to be perfect every time.
Exactly. I was going.
So, yeah. Yes. So, I mean, did lowering the expectations to today it was good. It was good enough and we just went off to sleep.
Okay. Mm-hmm. All right. So good enough. This is something that we're talking about. Good enough.
Yes.
Which leads me on to the question is, I guess, a couple of questions from that. First of all, how do you judge what is good enough? And second of all, if you were in a relationship and you haven't had that conversation about, okay, this is good enough, and you are expecting what media or in anything has fed us, whether it be pornography, whether it be Instagram, whatever, what is the impact on the relationship when it's not like that? Because I think this is really important.
Mm-hmm. I think on the other side of the coin, it's also important to not accept bad sex. So what I mean to say is that expectations both ways are wrong, in that we shouldn't accept if we're not feeling good, if we're not feeling comfortable. And we should also not expect everything to be excellent and perfect at all times. Now, how do we do that? Communication is the most important thing. Because whether we're enjoying it or not, unless we share that feedback to the other partner, to the other person, exactly, we're not going to get anywhere. So it's very important that we're assessing, even if it's good enough, if it's pleasurable, if I feel safe, if I feel good, if I feel okay in that context, that is good enough. But if something feels wrong, if I'm feeling any pain, if I'm not enjoying it, we shouldn't tolerate it because we have the idea that it doesn't need to be perfect at all times. I don't know if I'm explaining myself properly. So either way, it's about getting to a point where ideally, you don't get to a point. Ideally, you're communicating from the beginning. But if you're not, this is where we need to look at. And as relationships evolve, it's very important that we're able to discuss these things openly, because otherwise we may be stuck in a cycle where things don't improve or we're not comfortable and therefore not enjoying it, which if sex isn't enjoyable, that's definitely not good enough.
I want to come back and just pick up on something that you both said, because Anna, I think it was you that just mentioned just a moment ago about faking it. And we're talking about this term good enough. And this kind of redefines sex completely. I remember when we sat at the table and I shared the statistics, which somehow are burnt into my brain, that 97% of heterosexual men are going to orgasm during sex, only 62% of women. So there's a good chance that as a woman, we might not orgasm during sex. Does that mean it's not good?
That means that in heterosexual sex, most men don't know how to pleasure their partners.
Because that statistic applies to heterosexual women, right?
Because gay men, 95%, gay women, 88% orgasm. So the gap is between heterosexual men and heterosexual women. And most, the problem is that most men, because it's not a former fault of their own, this is what the narrative in our society, think that pleasure and orgasm and female pleasure is mainly vaginal. It's not. Female pleasure is mainly clitoral. And that is why there is this gap between heterosexual men and heterosexual women. Because gay women know exactly where to touch, where to... So 88% of gay women orgasm.
Well, I have this quote that when I was researching for the show, one of the biggest expectations I hear from women is that they believe they should be able to orgasm from penetrative penetrative sex alone, says Dr. Holly. In a 2017 study in the Journal of Sex and Marital Therapy, found that only 18% of women can orgasm solely from penetrative sex, while over 66% of women said they prefer direct clitoral touch. It's erroneous and still disheartening for me when a female client comes to see me believing that she is flawed and I know that she is completely normal. Sharing facts about female sexuality is long overdue and can be extraordinarily empowering. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's insane. Only 18%.
Yes.
Because this has been the narrative, even from a medical perspective, till very, very recently. I mean, the clitoris was dissected in the 1980s, 1990s. And we know that there are more than 10,000 nerve endings.
12,000. I did the research on that as well.
So in 1949, the clitoris as an anatomical part was completely removed from the medical textbook for trainee doctors. Completely removed. So this has been, this isn't just, this has been long coming that very recently we've been talking about female sexual pleasure, where it is, where does it come from, that very, very recently, these last 30, 40 years.
Especially because going back to expectations, when the stereotype is that it's intercourse, penis and vagina sex, to be clear, whereas for clitoral stimulation, there's a whole other aspect to sex. So when we're taught that, the reproductive part of it, that eliminates completely the clitoris, which is outside of the vaginal cavity, part of the vulva. So exactly, even medically, it wasn't considered.
So it brings me back to, this is so interesting, it brings me back to the question of, you use the term good enough. How do we define good enough? How would you define good enough?
I think it pretty much depends on what the goal, what the end goal is. And if we are making orgasm the end goal every time, realistically, then it's not always going to be successful.
True.
You know, we don't always need to orgasm we're not always going to for a variety of reasons.
Okay, so if the end goal isn't orgasm, what is the end goal?
Many other things, just enjoying that time with your partner, stress relief, being intimate, you know, sharing that sacred moment with someone else. I think it can vary a lot from one person to another.
So I'm going to stick with you. If then that there is not that understanding between couples and expectations are not realistic, what are the issues that couple is going to face? What if you could like pop on the middle of the table there? Okay, if expectations are not realistic, this is likely to happen.
Exactly. I think Nicola mentioned earlier, you know, a lot of disappointment because of the pressures that we're creating around sex. Be it, I want to orgasm every time, or perhaps we're not talking about how we want to be touched. Yes, it's going to create a lot of disappointment, anger, resentment.
See, these are big words. Mm. Anger, resentment, disappointment. We're talking about couples. I mean, I'm assuming that if it continues without being resolved, it could lead to a breakup that's maybe unnecessary.
It can spill over into the rest of the relationship as well.
We are talking here about sex in the context of a relationship.
Yeah.
And I think, first of all, what is good enough sex, it depends on, for example, from a practitioner's point of view, on the couple, on the individual you have in front of you. Good enough sex for a particular couple can look like cuddling every Sunday morning and touching each other. For another couple, it can look like having intercourse once a month or once every 3 weeks. So it really depends on who you're talking to, who you are working with from a practitioner's point of view. The problem becomes when the expectations of the good enough sex are different.
Nicola's like nodding away there.
Yes. When you have one of the partners wanting to be intimate once a week, one of the partners wanting to be intimate once a month because they're too tired, because they just had a child, because... And then it starts, as Pam well said, starts spilling over in the rest of the relationship. Because sexual problems are multifactorial. There are different, there's the biological factor. Is there a change in the individuals? Is there illness? Is there menopause? Is there childbirth? Mm. There is the relational factor. Is there conflict that has nothing to do with sex, that is really part and parcel of the couple's daily life? And then one or both are, it's very difficult for them to become vulnerable and intimate mm. sexually, because they are living in a very high conflict environment where they are triggering each other with so it's cultural. There's for example, here in Malta, although we have really moved forward in this, there's still a lot of shame around yes. sexuality, especially female sexuality.
Yes.
In a lot of countries, let's face it. And I'm always surprised about this, but I'm not surprised. I want to just recap for a second, because I want to keep coming back and just reiterating what we're saying. So we're saying that expectations versus reality, we shouldn't be aiming for perfection each time. We should be aiming for good enough. Yes. And good enough differs from one person to another. Yes. And it might not mean orgasm.
Exactly. Yes.
But you have to have that discussion.
Yes. Yes.
We've talked about this so many times. It's all about the discussion. So defining what is good enough is really the first port of call.
Yes.
And re-evaluating what their expectations are. I want to throw something else onto the table, because this is a big deal. This is something that has become exponentially more of a deal in recent years. And then that is sex that's portrayed in pornography is far from what most women want and find fulfilling for the most part. And I was reading about this, and whilst it may have a role in some relationships, we've talked about this before, there's also another element. One therapist that I read about quoted, "I've had several young women tell me about the vile and violent things boyfriends, husbands, partners have requested or demanded of them." Because more and more we're seeing that young people, men and women of all ages, are turning to pornography for whatever reason. And I was thinking about it, because I was thinking about this conflict, the unresolved, where people are getting their sexual fulfillment from. And that, we can't deny it, that still plays a role in, and it's very, very accessible. So let's put pornography on the table as well. Where does porn come into that? Because what is the reality of porn and the experience of a woman's sex life?
Mm-hmm.
How should we frame it?
I think the first thing that comes to mind for me is even the expectation in terms of body image, self-esteem. One thing I like to remind younger students when I'm working with schools, etc., is that when we're looking at pornography, we're looking at a doctored, scripted experience. It doesn't mean that parts of it aren't realistic, but they are models, they are actors, it's scripted. Of course, there are different kinds of pornography as well, but it's important to remind ourselves, even in terms of body, because a lot of people come forward with expectations and worries about mm-hmm. being naked with a partner, and you know, this is a part of the experiences and issues that clients present with,
yes.
Especially with regards to shame. So that's one thing that came to mind, the expectation even just visually, let's say, but also in the kind of sex that you can have, we've already looked at that it's always going to be, you know, something out of this world, or that it's always going to start off in a funny way, or, you know, these expectations can be because of pornography. But I think something that is developing, especially you mentioned in the Nordic countries and with the younger audiences, and I think it's really important, is porn literacy. And I think in the development of sex education that needs to happen here and in other countries, this needs to be very much put at the forefront. I mentioned this in my bachelor's thesis 8 years ago, and it's been 8 years since, and the things you've mentioned statistically are pretty much the same. So I think it's even more important now in this digitized world where even more and more things are happening online, things are expanding, and even in the world of sex work, etc. So it's very important that we become porn literate in understanding that what we're seeing isn't necessarily what we have to expect. And that ties in with what you said in terms of the expectations of the kind of sex, if we're looking at rough sex or, let's say, violence, etc. Now, I want to be very careful in saying that it's not necessarily that if we're viewing porn, we're going to expect this kind of maybe more rough sex. Some people like that, and that's totally fine. But they're usually, if we are predisposed to maybe a misogynistic perspective, that's where this comes in, and that's why this conversation needs to happen. Because there could be these risks for people that are more susceptible to certain ideologies, for example. But it's not always the case. So I like to err on the side of caution in, you know, looking at both sides of the coin.
Statistics show that there has been a rise in expectations for women to engage in acts that they wouldn't necessarily want to. That statistically, it says, I love what you just said there, because there's a quote that, like, again, as I was researching for the show, a Dr. Chavez says that there is misinformation everywhere regarding sex, which creates unrealistic expectations around relationships. Porn is also a source of education for most people, and it reinforces these misconceptions. People may not realize that porn is entertainment.
Yes.
And view the messages as reality. Mm-hmm. Now, two things popped out in that. First of all, it's entertainment. It's not real life.
Yes. Exactly.
Absolutely. And it comes back to what you're saying about porn literacy. But it also, it says here that most people, porn is a source of education for most people. I mean, wow.
We are also seeing a flow of what we call ethical pornography. Mm-hmm. So, and more erotica rather than hardcore porn. And that is usually more appealing to women. I get clients saying, I want to watch porn, but I want to know that who is involved in porn is being paid well. There's no form of abuse
or exploitation.
Yeah. So usually these ethical porn sites you pay for, and usually they are more female oriented. They are directed by women. The storyline is different. Most of them do not try to propagate the stereotypical secretary on a photocopier waiting with her feet apart.
It's always a secretary,
yes,
isn't it?
So, there's consent involved, because that is another problem in mainstream pornography. There is no consent. Someone touches your bum and you smile at him and open your legs.
The conversation isn't there.
There is no consent. So we are moving towards more ethical pornography. Clients actually ask for us to suggest ethical porn sites where they feel they can watch pornography as a form of entertainment. Again, it's not portraying reality, but there is no exploitation, and it is more female
focused.
I love this. I think that this, I've not heard of this ethical porn before, and I think it's just incredible and so needed. I mean, wow, empowerment for women, and amazing. I'm so thrilled to hear that. But we have to be realistic on the flip side of that. As much as that is emerging, when you have something like the internet and you have access, there's also degradation that is just exponentially becoming worse and worse and worse.
It's really worrying, I find. I think the minute that you reduce the person in front of you, you know, anything other than a human being, that's really worrying. It takes away the humanity of the person. So you always have to remember, you know, you're dealing with a whole other person with their own opinions, values, likes, dislikes, desires, fears, anything.
I think if we keep in mind that pornography is a form of entertainment, these boundaries are kept. That is fantasy. That is that. I mean, I get clients telling me I like pornography where there is rape involved. It doesn't mean I want to be raped. Exactly. Of course not. It's just a fantasy. It is just a sexual fantasy, and that is what pornography is. It is a form of entertainment. The problem is when there is no shift, and in a person's head, there is no, that's reality. That's how, especially when we have younger and younger individuals, we have 10 and 11 year olds seeing very hardcore pornography. Yes. And the brain is still, the neurological pathways are still forming. So I also will make a difference around who is seeing the pornography, their age, their maturity, because if and a 30-year-old is seeing pornography and an 11-year-old is seeing the same pornography, it's completely different.
Absolutely. Because we talked about more normalizing before. Mm-hmm. We talked about what is normalization. Well, for a young person who's 11 or 12, 13 years old, their understanding of what they're seeing in front of them, they're not going to be able to have that developed understanding that that is entertainment. With all due respect, there's 35-year-olds that can't do that.
Yes.
You mentioned about the non-consensual sex and persons having a preference for that kind of pornography. That worries me. I'll be honest with you. That worries me, and maybe that's their taste. But it comes down to that normality and normalizing. Because as we say, as we start getting to the point where more and more is permissible, then you have to look harder and harder for that kick. And further for that thrill. We know that. That's not...
And then, exactly what Nicola says, the importance of porn literacy. From a very young age, sex education should have porn literacy. Not you just have 1 hour in 5 years of secondary school.
Mm-hmm. That's focused on...
Do not watch porn. Okay, yes. Tell that to a group of 14-year-olds.
Goes back to the question of the more you know, the less you know, the more curious you are.
Exactly. Yeah.
And the less you talk about it, the more you're going to search by yourself and explore by yourself. But also, to go back to your thought, sexual fantasy can be very different, and usually is very different to what we want to experience with a partner. They can exist separately. So there is a distinction between our individual sexual identity and our partner's sexual identity. And it's very important for us to understand that we can have our own individual sexuality and we enjoy time with ourselves in solo sex, and that doesn't necessarily have to transition, or it can, but what we can enjoy with partnered sex doesn't need to be the same. And sexual fantasy is something that also lacks a lot of conversation and discussion. We can do a whole other show about
for
that.
Sure. This show's conversation is accompanied by Miral Chardonnay Terre Siciliane. This wine has beautiful aromas of tropical fruit, such as pineapple, with a mineral touch. This Miral Chardonnay is a straw yellow color with greenish reflections and is light, refreshing, and fruity. Here, Chardonnay shows all its fresh and tropical potential with a liveliness that's perfect for a lively conversation. Many thanks to What's in Your Glass, brought to you by M&Z Wines. You just said a whole bunch of things that I'm sitting there going, I have questions. I need to ask this, because is it not the case? I'm thinking about personal experience. I'm thinking about other people that I might know, is it not the case that if you are aware that your partner, when you're in the context of a relationship, has a particular fantasy, it can be quite threatening, can it not, to a person in the relationship? Because you're thinking to yourself, oh, hang on a second, that doesn't involve me. And that's not, because we have this expectation, don't we, that everything is about your partner, and your partner just has to smile at you and sit on the photocopier and you're all ready to go. I mean, there is that element of threat. And I think that's why it's difficult to talk about this fantasy by yourself and what you'd expect with your partner, because somewhere or other, there needs to be a conversation that marries the two into reality.
I can compare it to the love languages. Are you familiar with the love languages? Where we have,
I've forgotten
there are five different languages that we have in how we give and receive love. To give an example, the way I receive love may be through quality time, whereas my partner receives love through physical touch. And there's five categories, and we are all different.
Do you know them off by heart?
Quality time, acts of service, which is, for example, if I come home and find the laundry done, and that really makes me feel loved, to give an example. Gift giving, physical touch.
And sexual.
And indeed. Words of affirmation.
Words of affirmation.
So we will all have a bit of those and in different categories. It's the same with sexual desire. So some people are mostly feeling that sexual desire when it comes to kink, or maybe more physical, looking at similar to pornography, in that the naked body is what really gets me going. Whereas for someone else, it's the physical sensation, it's the mental stimulation. And it's about finding the balance between what I need and what I enjoy receiving and what I give to enjoy my partner enjoying the experience. So sometimes what I enjoy giving is different to what I enjoy receiving. And that's why the conversation is important, to find the middle ground. So we do need to remove the expectation that exactly what makes me tick is going to be the same as what makes my partner tick.
And how sexually compatible the couple is. We talk a lot about compatibility in terms of like values and what we want out of life. What about sex?
Mm-hmm.
How sexually compatible are we?
Can that be a make or break for a relationship if you're not sexually compatible?
It can.
And is that okay? Because if you find... I'm just thinking about this. I've got so many questions. But you know, I'm thinking, if you find someone that you really enjoy their company and you really like being, and you're attracted to them, but then you find out that their sexual preferences and expectations or their flavors are not the same as yours, is that a situation where you should be saying, okay, this is not a relationship that's going to work? Or do you find a middle ground? Or do you do one or the other?
It's again about conversation, about discussion, about communication,
negotiating.
Sometimes the couple manages to find a midpoint, like they negotiate who's going to do the laundry or who's going to cook today. Or sometimes the couple say, this is too important for me and I cannot have sex just once a month, for example. It's too important for me. It's part of my love language. And this is something that when Nicola was talking, it has been brewing in my head for some time in this program, but I feel the need to say, some individuals feel rejected if they don't have sexual intimacy. They interpret it as something that has to do with them. If my partner is tired and I approach him for sex and he says, I'm too tired today, sometimes I might feel this is rejection. This is rejection of who I am as a human being. And this ties very nicely with what we've been discussing around porn, because porn becomes a problem in relationships when sex in the relationship is not happening.
Yes.
When my partner is not being intimate with me, and then I find him masturbating to pornography. That is when, at least in my experience, in my clinical work, pornography becomes a problem. When we are not being intimate. We are, I want to feel your touch. I want you to come close to me, to love me in that way. But then, and it's not happening. Maybe it hasn't been happening for months. But then I come one fine day and find you masturbating. Pornography and masturbation is usually not a problem if there is awareness from both ends that this is happening, there's discussion, there's conversation. But when there's secrecy, when sex is not satisfying in the couple, then pornography becomes a problem. At least that is my experience from a clinical
point of view. Well, I'm going to suggest that that's not an uncommon problem. I'm going to say that's probably more of a common problem than we're probably happily ready to admit. I should imagine that that is quite often an issue at some point in some couples' relationships, if we're really honest.
But I would say it's probably because it's never been addressed as something that happens. We don't talk about the fact that either one of us is watching porn or watches porn. So then it's done in secrecy. So then it's... it becomes more of an issue than it needs to be had we negotiated the discussion around it in the earlier part of the relationship.
So what's the way, how do we navigate that? Bearing in mind, I actually, through conversations, you know, life experience and so on and so forth, I should imagine that this is something that most women and men can identify with. How do we negotiate that? And let's talk about it from your point then, Nicola, right from the very beginning, that needs to be part of a conversation. I assume that's what you're going to say. I'm speaking for you. But then once, so I'd like to address that as once what happens at the very beginning, and then once that's in your relationship, what do you do then? Just walk away?
I think like with many other issues, it's about understanding what our boundaries are. And that's why I mentioned discussing it in the beginning, because some people have a firm boundary with not wanting pornography to be part of the dynamic. Some people are happy that pornography is part of individual sexual experiences as long as there is sex happening between the relationship. And then there's in between, right? So if something is going wrong, like with any other issue, we could be on the same page at about who's doing the laundry and who's doing the dishes. And then things happen in life and suddenly the house is a mess. We need to discuss that and figure out how we're going to navigate that. It's the same with sex. So sometimes, you know, there's another expectation is that in a relationship is 50-50. Sometimes it's 80-20 for a couple of years. And then at some point it needs to rebalance because life. Sometimes I'm more stressed. Sometimes you're more stressed. It's the same with sex. At some point, what we've expected or what we've been used to the first year, the first 6 months, the first couple of years, it's going to change because we change. It's going to change with our bodies, with our development, with age, with children, with lifestyle. So like any other issue, if porn has suddenly become an issue, we'd need to discuss where our boundaries lie and what we're happy to accept and not.
I'm going to stop you there because you just said something that really triggered with me. I think if we're really honest, there are so many factors that affect our sex lives. You've just listed a couple of them, but I want to throw into the middle of the table pretty much a big pool of factors that can affect our sex lives to normalize the fact that sex isn't always our top priority. Mm-hmm. Anna mentioned menopause. Oh, ladies, have you got a whole fault load looking forward to that? But menopause does, doesn't it?
Yes.
It affects your sex life. It affects your sex drive. It affects the shape of your intimate parts and the way that they react. Yeah. There's so much.
Kids.
Okay, pop them on the table. I want a big, big bowl of everything.
Okay, let's start throwing stuff
absolutely
in.
Absolutely. Just throw them in. Anything you want.
Health issues.
Like?
Well, certain treatments, certain medications that you could be on if you have diabetes, if you have heart disease,
if you have depression,
if you have mental health difficulties.
Mental health as well,
in fact,
right?
Something else that was in my mind to come up at a point is the expectation that sex is always going to happen in terms of physical ability. Sometimes sexual dysfunctions come forward out of nowhere or they were already existing. That's another thing that could throw a spanner in the works and would need to deal with that.
Any kind of hormonal changes?
Yes.
Loss, grief.
Okay. You mentioned children.
Childbirth. Having the fatigue, the extreme fatigue I get in young parents coming for therapy because you're not sleeping, you're not eating well. Sometimes you forget when you had your shower last. You're trying to juggle work and having a young kid and or two. That changes the whole dynamics of then when you're brew a cup of tea at 8:30 at night and the kid is asleep, you sit down on the sofa and sleep. It's because you're exhausted. You woke up 4 times during the night. That's a huge game changer for individuals becoming a parent.
You also mentioned stress.
Stress and is
our,
a big
our
one.
Our lives are now so incredibly more, I don't want to say stressful, but there's more constant stress. Mm-hmm. Less alone guilt, grief or anything like that, but it could be changing your job, could be, I mean, you tell me, I'm not, you're the ones.
Changing your house.
Yes. Uh-huh.
Moving house. Trudy. Twice.
Yes, twice and country.
So these are huge lists. I mean, in distress
index
changing house, having a kid, losing a loved one. These are normal part of our lives and they are 100% each one,
and
each one of them.
And these can all impact mm-hmm.
our desire. Yeah, it can impact how frequently you're up for having sex. And this is where the negotiation comes in, because one thing that we maybe help our clients navigate is maybe changing the time that you're expecting to have sex. Have sex in the morning, first thing when you're fresh, instead of expecting it to happen at night. It's true. Scheduling sex.
Not expecting, that's what I was going to say, sex to be spontaneous, because we're used to seeing films and people tearing each other's clothes off. But that doesn't happen in real life. Let's be realistic.
I love you.
I mean, and I've read a quote recently by the Australian Society of Sexologists, which was brilliant, because actually most couples tell me, but sex was so spontaneous in the first 1-2 years of our relationship. Of course it wasn't. Of course, not even, I mean, a part of the fact that physically, biologically, you are geared because there's what we call the Coolidge effect. The Coolidge effect. It's having a new partner increases desire. And yes, it's true. But apart from that, it wasn't spontaneous at all. You prepared for hours to meet. Come on, where is the spontaneity?
That it's true.
Then dawned on me. I've never seen it in this way. Of course, it wasn't spontaneous the first 6 months and the year.
So true.
You went to wax and to of course it
I
wasn't
proper.
I've never thought of it either. It was a realization I made very recently. Of course it wasn't spontaneous the first couple of months. You dolled yourself up and
you went on a date and you knew that
your male partner went to the barber every time before
some new lingerie.
Before he met you, you went to
You learned each other's quirks and
before you had the dog waking you up at 2 o'clock in the morning because he's it's still a puppy and
I thought you were going to say something completely different.
No, but it wasn't. My point is, it wasn't spontaneous the first 6 to 8 months to a year. If we really think about it, it was quite planned.
Or at least taught.
Or prepared for.
Yeah.
You know, so.
I love that. That is super reassuring, isn't it?
It was a realization.
I love that. I absolutely love that. Look, I want to, there's a couple of topics that I want to really put some practical application to. And I love you ladies being at this table because I keep asking this question over and over and over again, but I don't think we can hear the answers to this enough. Expectations versus reality. We've talked about the fact that you need to find that place that you're both comfortable. You need to find the good enough. You need to negotiate. If somebody likes chocolate chip ice cream and someone likes vanilla, are you going to put it in the same scoop? Are you going to, you know, mix up and put
no vanilla has
top?
Connotations.
Yeah, I know.
Pun intended.
Thank you. Yes, Pam. Absolutely. Stick the flake in there.
I remember the episode of the vanilla with a flake.
The vanilla with the, yes. Anyway, so We've talked about that. We've talked about the fact that communication, again, communication is so key. And we're going to come back to this communication in just a second, because I want to keep reiterating how we communicate. But before we go much further, I just want to say, in this idea, we've talked about pornography and the fact that pornography can be part of a relationship as long as it's included in the conversation, as long as the partner knows. It's when it becomes secretive and when it becomes something else. And we've also talked about, and I love what you said about the fact that fantasy in a relationship is not necessarily fantasy outside of the relationship, and that is okay. Yes. What turns you on by yourself is not necessarily what turns you on when you're with a partner. Or even if you're not with a partner, if you're with somebody for a one-night stand or an experience or whatever. And that leads me on to this. Where do we say what is okay and what's not okay? What should we accept and what should we not accept? How do we define that?
I think it's something I've been wanting to say since we've been on the show today. A step before communication is awareness. If we are not firstly aware of what we like, what we don't like, how can we be expected to communicate that to our partners? If there's all this shame and guilt, you know, embedded into our own narratives when it comes to sex, we're likely never going to self-explore, you know, to know what feels good, what we like and what we don't, let alone communicate that with our partner. So I think that is the first step.
Yes.
I'll never forget the look of horror on my face. It's quite subconsciously when I think it was Anna that turned around and said, you have to whip out your mirror and have a look at your vagina.
Yes, compact
it's your vulva.
Yes.
But it's true. It we is. Have to know ourselves.
Yes.
I think this is a super, super good point. Okay, so we're going to put that into the table of everything that we're taking away. That's the first point. You need to know what you find satisfying. Mm-hmm. And I think, like you said, does this not come back to the idea of shame?
Yeah.
Because I think for a lot of us, particularly women, we might know, but talking about it is shameful. Even communicating is shameful.
Yes.
And we need to stop with that, don't we? Yes. We need to just eliminate that shame.
Yes.
So that ties very nicely into this idea of what do we accept and what do we not accept. If we know what we like,
yes,
how far should we go to please our partner so that that expectation versus reality becomes normalized?
Yeah.
It's really about consent.
Exactly.
So knowing yourself, knowing what you like, knowing what your partner likes, and thinking and deciding if you're okay with it. Mm-hmm. I get so many women in clinic where there was actual rape or abuse, but they don't even realize. Let me explain. For example, they're having sex with someone. At one point, they something is off and they decide not to have penetrative sex, but their partner is aroused, they are aroused, but they say, I'm not feeling comfortable, there's pain, please stop. And the partner continues. And it takes sometimes years for them to realize that that was unconsensual sex. Yes. You did not say yes to that.
And when asked, 87% of women said that they've had sex when they really didn't want to.
Yes. Exactly.
And that could be, I mean, I remember having a conversation about this. Women say yes when they don't want to for all sorts of reasons, maybe because they just want to get out of the situation. Yeah. And they say, okay, if we just do it and get out of it, I can move on. I can get out of where I'm at. And that's not okay.
Yes. Yeah. So it's about consent. Yes. and having the hard conversations.
I was thinking about consent. And I know it can exist in like a variety of ways. There's something, I don't know if you ladies know, perhaps, of the wheel of consent.
Yes.
Us that don't know, tell me about the wheel of consent.
That's the thing. That's why I turned to them, because I can't remember the... I know there was something like, you know, about saying yes enthusiastically, not just going along with it.
Yes,
that's another factor.
Wasn't it you, Nicola, yes, that talked about... Give me the wheel of consent.
So the wheel of consent includes what I mentioned earlier, in that there are aspects that we're willing to give but maybe not receive. And there are aspects that we're willing to give and receive but not give, etc. So that's part of the wheel. And also in that consent needs to be ongoing, it needs to be voluntary, it needs to be affirmative, it needs to be sober, which is something that is very important. And it needs to be honest. And that's why, going back to Pamela and the awareness, we also have to be honest with ourselves and understanding this wasn't okay, or this did make me feel good and I need to understand why. Because when we are having sex, whether it's with a one-nighter or in a relationship, what is definitely not on the table ever is when I'm not comfortable and I don't want to do it. So it should never be acceptable. And a no is always a no, and a yes is a yes, but you can withdraw consent at any time. And that's why what Anna said is very important, because regardless of how far into the sexual experience you are, if something happens and you want to stop, you have the right to stop.
And almost many, at least the women I've met in my clinical practice around this, almost feel they should continue with the sexual activity, although they don't want to. And there is almost guilt and shame around, oh, no, he's aroused. I mean, yeah. I bought him, brought him or her to this position. Now I have to just...
And I'm going to be very clear about this. We're talking about this in the context of where we're at in Malta, but that is not just Malta. Yeah. That is everywhere, and yes, every woman has experienced this. Mm-hmm. You mentioned there, Nicola, because we talked about this. I remember you sitting there and talking emphatically, both these ladies that have been here before, and you've just mentioned it as well, Pam, is that no is no and no is always no and no should be respected as no. I remember you sat there, and I'm going to say it again because I think most women are unaware of this. I mentioned it the other day and the women that I was with were like, really? You said that if you are over the limit, if you've had alcohol, you are not able to legally consent to sex. Yes.
And drugs.
I think and drugs, of
marijuana,
course.
Marijuana. And
I think it's worth... I remember thinking, well, what does that mean? You can't go out for a glass of wine and have a glass of wine and then have sex with your husband. No, it doesn't mean it at all. What it means is that actually the consent is so important and it is so serious that if you have been drinking or taking drugs or anything like that, that you are liably incapable of being able to consent to a situation that you potentially don't want to be in.
Yes.
It shocked me when you said that. Every time I've repeated it, just everyone's going, are you serious? But when you think about it, it makes sense.
Yes.
Yes.
So what should you not accept? What should you accept? Anything that you want to. What you should not accept is anything you don't.
Anything that is painful.
Yes.
If there is pain if it's not chosen pain around kink and BDSM, but I'm talking about pain that you don't want. So if there is penetrative sex and it's painful, there's dyspareunia, which is painful sexual intercourse, there is any form of pain, usually the first thing we do as a sex therapist is advise penetrative sex to stop. So pain is not okay. Anything you don't consent to is not okay. And again, conversation, having the hard conversations.
I'm so glad you said that, because I, just as you mentioned that, I was thinking about this whole idea about communication. And I read this phenomenal quote that I want to share with you. The sex and relationship guru that this is from, Dr. Chavez, encourages everyone to take the reins of their own sexual experience and start talking. A partner cannot give you an orgasm. Wow. A partner cannot give you an orgasm, she explains. You are responsible for showing a partner how they can contribute to an environment where an orgasm can happen.
Yes.
Is that, that dropped with me. I was just like, hang on a second. A partner cannot give you an orgasm. It's something you...
Taking
like
responsibility
you
for your own sexual pleasure.
Exactly. It has to be mutually responsible.
Yes.
We cannot, as women, as people in general, expect our partners... just figure it out. We have to give them some guidance.
Even time.
Arrows. Flags. Arrows.
Even the expectation of time. We take different time to get there. I mean, for men, it's usually much shorter than for women. Mm-hmm. So even navigating that, but regardless of the relationship, whether to men, everybody's going to be different anyway. But even that expectation. And these are all things that aren't addressed in pornography. And that's why we need, again, to look at it as entertainment, because we don't see the conversation around consent. We don't see the use of condoms. We don't see, or sometimes, but usually there isn't lubrication and understanding that maybe I've gotten a bit dry. I need some lubrication. These things aren't featured in porn as part of the conversation that needs to happen. Mm. So we all will need different things at different time, and that's the expectation that needs to change. Or we create an expectation that there should be a conversation. Maybe that's how we reframe it. Mm. The expectation should be that we talk about these things.
When you were saying that you would talk about entertainment, that's really blown me away having that conversation today, because as you were saying that, I was thinking about Mission Impossible. I was thinking to myself, you know, Mission Impossible is entertainment. We love watching, what's his name, jumping off, what is his name, Tom Cruise, jumping off cliffs on motorbikes and falling to the ground. But we enjoy watching it, but we wouldn't necessarily want to do that.
Yes.
Some of us might, but that's not something we want to do. So I'm going to come back and I'm going to ask a question that I've asked before on this show, and that is communication. How do we do it? How do we have that? I know, because I know that you've given some really good advice on this, Anna. Pam, how do we as partners, as new partners, or maybe it's just somebody that you think you might want to enjoy sex with, how do we have that conversation? How do we start the communication? Because it's not easy.
It's not easy, exactly. And if there's a lot of shame and anxiety just thinking about the topic, because it's so taboo and it's so stigmatized, it's going to make the conversation much more difficult. But maybe finding the appropriate time, you know, planning what do you want to address during the conversation, doing anything that can help to make it easier, perhaps, you know. So choosing the right time, the right place, atmosphere, ambience, whatever, you know. And maybe even preparing your partner, hey, I want to discuss this, perhaps. Can we choose the right time and place to do that?
Yes.
And really just, I think you just have to take the plunge at some point. It's not easy. It's never easy. But you might learn a thing or two. You're probably going to anyway.
I think that is exactly what Anna said before. You're reiterating that, and you said it so beautifully, finding the right time, finding the right place and taking the plunge. I mean, committing to it and saying, I'm going to do it. Something else struck as you were talking, I think our dialogue, we've mentioned this at the table before, but the way that you frame your dialogue and not, you don't do this and you did this wrong, because immediately, no matter what you're talking about, your partner is, or whoever you're talking to, is going to be on the back foot. And you're not going to get anywhere by saying that. I always feel that it's important to frame, we could maybe think about making this more satisfactory for, or
even
more
using I statements. Yes. All the time.
And taking ownership.
Taking ownership.
Because, and that's very important what you're saying, because without knowing, you're perpetuating the shame even more.
Yeah.
Because I'm unintentionally shaming you at not having satisfied me, for example. So the way we have conversations, and the more safety we create around it, the easier it is to talk about it the next time and the next time and the next time. But this is also in the context of relationships mostly. But even when it comes to one-nighters or casual sex, the more that I tie back to what Pam said earlier, the more that I'm confident in myself and I explore my own shame and I deal with whatever it is I need to feel confident in myself, the easier it is to own what I like and to be frank about it. This is what I like, this is what I want, and a bit less of that, a bit more of this. And the more you take the plunge, the more easy it becomes over time, which sounds super obvious, but because it is sex, we take it for granted that maybe it won't, or it's always awkward, but it doesn't need to be.
You said something really big there, and I want to touch on that for a second.
Can I say something?
Oh, all right.
Thank you.
I love you.
I feel also, and I hope I practice this myself. I've become better over the many years I've been with the same man. And I try to also include it in the couple work I do. Be kind. in the conversation. It's so important. Sometimes our partners are the persons we are most rough with in the words we use. Mm. Be kind. I mean, yes, it's important to have a good sexual life, but use words that won't hurt the other person because they might be doing really their best and mm-hmm. maybe they're not aware that you are passing through this and not being sexually satisfied and not having good enough sex. So kindness and the way we create the safety in the conversation is really, really important.
Doing the PNP sandwich.
The what?
I've never heard of
this. I am never going to forget the fact that Pam came and said the PNP sandwich. What is the PNP sandwich?
So if you're going to provide some criticism to your partner, try and slide it in between two positives. So P, positive, and for negative, and then another positive. Mm, so like I really love that when you do this for me, for example. But then that perhaps I didn't really like as much. Perhaps we could try something different next time. Oh, but I really love like the way you give me aftercare, for example, you know. So
PMP. I was thinking something completely different.
Sorry, I hope I did not lose your train of thought.
No. I was coming back to what Nicola said a moment ago, because she talked about if you aren't in a relationship. And this I want to touch on, and this is very rarely talked about. If you aren't in a long-term relationship, how can you achieve successful sexual fulfillment? Because unless we have that conversation, we're just totally eliminating a whole portion of the population.
So first of all,
I just want to do an impression of that. It's like Anna's about to say something, but I'm along the right lines, no?
Yes. First of all, solo sex is really important, and especially as
say
women.
Say that one again.
So masturbating, solo sex. That is really important. We, as Pam said, as Nicola said, we need to know what we like, what we don't like. Otherwise, we're not going to be able to teach it to someone else. And there is also, so masturbating, knowing your bodies, knowing who you are, embracing who you are, and then translating that in casual sex, in our relationships. Because if we know what we like sexually, if we are assertive and secure in who we are sexually, then it will be easier to have good enough sex with someone else. It has to start from the assurance. I'm not sure what my colleagues here think, but it has to start from the assurance and the self-confidence of knowing what I like and satisfying myself.
I'm just going to catch you because you look like you thought for a moment and then you said good enough sex. And I love the fact that we're redefining what the expectations versus reality are. And I'm going to take this away. Good enough sex. I'm going to take this away. This is a phrase I think we need to just keep saying over and over. I caught you just stopping yourself before you said what you said there, and you said good enough rather than any other adjective, any other describing word for that. And process, well done to you, because I'm now, it's stuck in my head. I'm always going to think of Anna as good enough sex. But sorry, you were saying, Nicola, about this whole idea of pursuing having a fulfilled sexual life if we are single.
Yes, I mean, I totally agree with what Anna said. And I think it's also about, you know, self-empowerment and that you are allowed to enjoy sex and to want sex, whether you're in a relationship or not. And you're allowed to have it safely and for it to be fulfilling. And for you to do that, it is important to understand the power of yes and the power of no. And also, again, what we've been repeating, knowing yourself and expressing what you want and what you need. You have every right to have pleasurable sex that is good enough and that is as frequent or as not frequent as you want, regardless of what kind of relationship or dynamic you're in. So, yes, this is a very important, I'm very glad we had this conversation about expectations and reality, because across the board, we need to be more aware that it's not necessarily what we're seeing and what we're expecting and what we've learned and what we've heard, and that it's going to be different whether you're single or in a relationship or somewhere in between.
I want to come back to close, on the back of what you just said there, and coming right back to something that Pamela said right at the very beginning, because we're talking about us, but we identify that the education is incredibly important. Nicola, you mentioned education in the Nordic countries. I can see a mass exodus from the Mediterranean up to the Nordic countries. Quick, they're having great sex up there. But it struck me when I sat down here that we have a lot of mums, parents who listen to this show. And we talked about the fact that this needs to be part of a conversation very, very early on. And I started off the show by saying that sex education, I don't believe, has massively changed in the last 35 years. So if you are a mum or a parent listening to this show, watching us having this conversation, how on earth, we've talked about how you can frame that conversation with a partner or somebody that you are involved with, intimately involved with, but how do you have that conversation with children? Because surely that's where we start with them. How on earth do you sit down and talk to your 6-year-old, 8-year-old, 4-year-old, 14-year-old about sex and expectations versus reality?
I think the fact that you're just mentioning different ages also plays a part in this, because it does have to be age appropriate. So what you would explain to a 4 or 6-year-old wouldn't be the same thing you would be explaining to a 14-year-old. I think that's the first and most important thing, probably. And this is probably then going to perpetuate the kind of narrative that the kids grow up with themselves, because if sex was never spoken about in my household, what kind of relationship am I going to have with sex as an adult in my future relationships? So these conversations do actually need to be had. Probably more like American television, it's called like the birds and the bees talk.
Yes.
Something like that.
But the birds and the bees, exactly that. But the birds and the bees, which we use the term in English. My mum said we need to have a birds and bees conversation, and then she handed me a book. Sorry, mum. and avoided the whole birds and the bees. We've been calling it birds and bees for a long time. But birds and bees usually refers to the functionality. Birds and bees don't orgasm, quite frankly, to put it in context. So how do we then discuss... How I'm wanting to see guidance for a parent,
yes,
no matter how old their child is. Absolutely. I hadn't even thought about that. It's got to be age appropriate. But how is a parent going to tackle this so that their child's education comes from them and not from a source that would ill-equip them for the future?
I think first and foremost, I want to say that to any parent listening, it's okay if you have questions. It's okay if this is scary. And there's things that you need to research and learn yourself. And that's why these podcasts and these kinds of talks and workshops are important to attend, even as a parent, to learn more about that. I think building a relationship with your children where you can have tough conversations about anything is already a great framework to be able to have conversations about sex. So first of all, I think sitting with our children and asking about what we're learning in school and all of that, that could also be a way that we're, starting the conversation. But sometimes having this space where kids can ask us questions, any questions, that gives us the opportunity as well to talk about relationships. But I would also say, think about your own experience of sex education and your own family dynamic and what you learned or didn't learn and what questions did you have. And how would you have wanted it to be addressed differently? Because even that could be a starting point to reflect on how would I want it to be different for my kids and navigate that from there. Because every family is going to be different. Some are more open. Maybe some parents are more affectionate in front of their kids. Others aren't. So even in that comfort level of kids coming forward. But yeah.
Kids ask. So we need to normalize. If they ask, we answer in an age appropriate way. And as Nicola said, creating an environment in the family where they can ask us anything, not just about sex, about anything else. I like to throw in this example. If my four-year-old, my five-year-old, came from kindergarten to from year one primary school, crying their eyes out because they fought with their first friend, and I dismiss it and say, oh, come on, so you'll find other friends, tomorrow it will be better, my kid will feel this is not important. So then when they are 10, 11, 12, and they see pornography for the first time and can't explain because cognitively they're not in a place to understand what is happening, they're not going to come to me with that bigger problem because I shamed them when they were, I invalidated their concern when they were five and six. And for them, losing a friend was the biggest problem in the world. So having this atmosphere where we let our kids ask us anything, and when we do not know, we admit it and say, I need to do some research about this. I need to go on a parent course about sex education because I can't help you in this. Or we need to talk to your guidance teacher at school or to your PSCD teacher. Having this kind of conversation and normalizing talking about sex in the house, not putting off changing the channel when there is a sex, because we all experience this.
Of course, there is a
hot scene.
Absolutely, quick.
And So normalizing and not shaming them for their choices, for their questions, because kids question, especially teenage kids, are in a questioning phase about their sexuality, about their sexual orientation.
Coming back to something that Nicola said, and this is my last question, I assure you. But coming back to something that Nicola said is that, oh, it might have even been you, Pam, I can't remember, but you mentioned that our reference point is our own education. I think you said, Nicola, how we learnt, how would we want to teach? It's still, I'm not a parent, but I can only imagine that that is absolutely terrifying. If you didn't receive a good education, the chances are the prospect, whilst you know the importance, the prospect of delivering that education is really terrifying. Are there resources out there that can support parents in talking to their kids about sex?
For sure, I'm seeing more and more workshops, even locally,
yes,
where information is being shared and parent groups. There are definitely more resources that are coming forward. But I think, I mean, there's plenty of websites that are reputable where we can find information about sex education, even in Malta, sexual health related questions, etc. But we can also always ask, Anna mentioned guidance teachers, medical professionals, you know, taking a daughter to a first gynecological appointment to address any questions related to medical. Even this, you know, having the conversation around medical appointments and how early to go, they're all things that we need to think about as parents and navigating that, as awkward as it is. But that's why I mentioned that it's okay that it feels awkward or jarring or, you know, a bit anxious. And that's where we need to challenge our own shame and be kind with ourselves in that we are allowed to have these unanswered questions that we can ask help to answer.
Okay. Well, I'm going to grill you later on for those resources, and I'm going to pop some websites and some online resources underneath this chat right here. So if you're listening to this on Spotify, if you're watching on YouTube, you'll find those underneath. I'm going to ask these ladies for those. Ladies, closing thoughts. We always do this, Pam. I'm going to put you on the spot, so I'm going to come to you last. But closing thoughts, your closing thoughts on the topic. I'm going to come back to the title because I was actually quite proud of the title, and I'm going to ask you guys to give me your closing thoughts on the topic of women and pleasurable sex, expectations versus reality, and everything you need to know. In a sentence.
a sentence.
It's a lot to wrap up.
What's the most important thing to you?
I think the most important thing is to understand that every experience is different. And the more you know yourself and the more confident you become in your own sexuality, the easier it is to navigate these challenges, be they dysfunctions, be they relationship issues, be they queries about anything to do with sex. So I would say do your research, ask questions, seek help when there's any issues that need to be dealt with. And it's okay that sometimes things come up and challenge us when it comes to this topic.
Brilliant. Brilliant.
I would say do not be afraid to be vulnerable, because this is a topic where we need to be vulnerable. That's why it's called intimacy. And manage expectations, have the hard conversations, and good enough sex is good enough.
Good enough.
Good enough.
Good enough. I'm taking that with me. Pam, you have the last word on this show.
As Nicola said, I think it's like a lot to wrap up, but like some takeaways probably from me would be to get to know your body, you know, get to know what you enjoy, what you don't, to be able to have those conversations with your partner. I think I'd like to see society's narrative sort of moving forward towards being more free, I guess, to explore or not, whatever people like, free of shame, free of guilt. Mm. That would be lovely.
Well, cheers to that. Cheers to good enough sex in every way, shape or form.
Cheers.
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 Gin, gin. Oh, that was a goodie show, wasn't it?
It was.
Oh, I like getting